longer. Fairly typical of the U.S. military. Ryan sat on a comfortable couch and drifted off to sleep for perhaps half an hour. The rabbits arrived by car. A USAF sergeant shook Jack awake and pointed him to the waiting KC-135. It was essentially a windowless Boeing 707, also equipped to refuel other aircraft. The lack of windows didn't help his attitude very much, but orders were orders, and he climbed up the steps and found a plush leather seat just forward of the wing box. The aircraft had hardly lifted off the ground when Oleg fell into the seat beside his own.
"What happened?" Zaitsev demanded.
"We caught Strokov. I got him myself, and he had a gun in his hand," Ryan reported. "But there was another shooter."
"Strokov, you arrested him?"
"Not exactly an arrest, but he decided to come with me to the British Embassy. SIS has him now."
"I hope they kill this Voloch," Zaitsev snarled.
Ryan didn't reply, wondering if that might actually happen. Did the Brits play that rough? He had committed rather a nasty murder on their soil. Hell, within sight of Century House.
"The Pope, will he live?" the rabbit asked.
Ryan was surprised to see his degree of interest. Maybe the guy was a real conscience defector after all.
"I don't know, Oleg.
I called my wife. She's a surgeon. She says that it's better than a 50-50 chance that he will survive."
"That is something," Zaitsev thought out loud.
"Well?" Andropov asked. Colonel Rozhdestvensky stood a little more erect. "Comrade Sherman, we know little at this point. Strokov's man took the shot, as you know, and he hit his target in a deadly area. Strokov was unable to eliminate him as planned for reasons unknown. Our Rome resident Yuri is working carefully to discover what happened. Colonel Goderenko is taking personal charge. We will know more when Colonel Strokov flies back to Sofia. He is scheduled to be on the regular flight at 19 hours. So, to this point, it appears we have had a partial success."
"There is no such thing as a partial success, Colonel," Andropov pointed out heatedly.
"Comrade Sherman, I told you weeks ago that this was a possibility. You will recall that. And even if this priest survives, he will not be going back to Poland anytime soon, will he?"
"I suppose not," Yuri Vladimirovich grumbled.
"And that was the real mission, wasn't it?"
"Da," the chairman admitted.
"No signals as yet?"
"No, Comrade Chairman.
We've had to break in a new watch officer in communications and..."
"What is that?"
"Major Zaitsev, Oleg Ivanovich. He and his family died in a hotel fire in Budapest. He had been our communicator for Mission 666.
"Why was I not informed of this?"
"Comrade Chairman," Rozhdestvensky soothed, "it was fully investigated. The bodies have been returned to Moscow and were duly buried. They all died of smoke inhalation. The autopsy procedures were viewed in person by a Soviet physician."
"You are sure of this, Colonel?"
"I can get the official report to you if you wish," Rozhdestvensky said with confidence. "I have read it myself."
Andropov shook it off.
"Very well. Keep me informed on whatever comes in, and I want to be notified at once of the condition of this troublesome Pole."
"By your order, Comrade Chairman."
Rozhdestvensky made his way out while the chairman went back to other business. Brezhnev's health had taken a definite downturn. Very soon Andropov would have to step away from KGB in order to protect his ascension to the head seat at the table, and that was the main item on his plate at the moment. And besides, Rozhdestvensky was right.
This Polish priest would not be a problem for months, even if he survived. And that was sufficient to the moment.
"Well, Arthur?" Ritter asked.
"He's calmed down a little bit. I told him about Operation Beatrix. I told him that we and the Brits had people right there. He wants to meet the rabbit we just got out, personally. So he's still pretty pissed, but at least it's not at us," Moore reported on his arrival back from the White House.
"The Brits have this Strokov guy in custody," Greer let the DCI know. Word had just come in from London.
"Would you believe Ryan's the guy who put the bag on him? The Brits have him now at their Rome embassy. Basil's trying to decide what to do with him. Best bet, Strokov ran the operation and enlisted this Turkish thug to do the shooting. The Brits say they caught him with a silenced pistol in his hand. The thinking is that his job was to take the shooter out, like that mafia hit in New York a while back, to put big league deniability on the assassination attempt."
"Your boy captured him?" the DCI asked in some surprise.
"He was there with a team of experienced British field spooks, and maybe his marine training helped," Ritter allowed. "So, James, your fair-haired boy gets another attaboy."
"Don't bite your tongue off when you sign the letter of commendation, Robert," Greer managed not to say.
"Where are they all now?"
"Halfway home, probably.
The Air Force is flying them over," Ritter told them. "ETA at Andrews is about 11:40, they told me."
There were windows in the front office, Ryan found out, and the flight crew was friendly enough. He was even able to talk a little about baseball. The Orioles had just one more game to win to finish the Phillies off, he was pleased and surprised to learn. The flight crew didn't even hint at asking why they were driving him back to America. They'd done it too many times, and besides, they never got good answers anyway. Aft, the rabbit family was sound asleep, a feat Ryan had not yet managed to accomplish.
"How long?" he asked the pilot.
"Well, that's Labrador there," he pointed. "Call it 3 hours more, and we'll be feet dry almost all the way.
Why don't you get some sleep, sir?"
"I don't sleep in the air," Jack admitted.
"Don't feel too bad, sir."
"Neither do we," the co-pilot told him.
And that was good news, on reflection, Jack thought. Sir Basil Charleston was having his own meeting with his chief of government at the moment. Neither in America nor in the UK did reporters write stories about when and why the chiefs of the various intelligence services met with their political masters.
"So tell me about this Strokov fellow," she ordered.
"Not a very pleasant chap," C replied. "We reckon he was there to kill the actual shooter. He had a suppressed weapon to eliminate the noise. So it would appear that the idea was to kill His Holiness and leave a dead assassin behind. Dead men still tell no tales, you see, Prime Minister. But perhaps this one will, after all. The Italian police must be chatting with him right now, I would imagine. He is a Turkish national, and I'll wager he had a criminal record and or experience in smuggling things into Bulgaria."
"So it was the Russians who were behind this?" she asked.
"Yes, ma'am. That seems virtually certain. Tom Sharp is talking to Strokov in Rome. We'll see how loyal he is to his masters."
"What will we do with him?" the PM asked. The answer was in the form of another question that she would have to answer. She did. It did not occur to Strokov that when Sharp invoked the names of Alexei Nikolaevich Rozhdestvensky and Ilya Fedorovich Bubovoy, his own fate was sealed. He was merely dumbfounded that the British Secret Intelligence Service had the KGB so thoroughly penetrated. Sharp saw no reason to disabuse him of that notion.
shocked beyond his capacity to react intelligently, Strokov forgot all of his training and started singing. His duet with Sharp lasted 2.5 hours, all of it on tape. Ryan was more on autopilot than the Boeing was before it touched down at runway 01 right at Andrews Air Force Base. He'd been on the go for, what, 22 hours? Something like that. Something more easily done as a Marine second lieutenant, age 22, than as a married father of two, age 32, who'd had a fairly stressful day. He was also feeling his liquor somewhat. There were two cars waiting at the bottom of the steps. Andrews had yet to install a jetway. He and Zaitsev took the first. Mrs. Rabbit and the bunny took the second. 2 minutes after that, they were on Suitland Parkway, heading into D.C. Ryan drew the task of explaining what they were passing along the way. Unlike his arrival in England, Zaitsev was not under the impression that this might be a maskirovka, and the detour past the Capitol building ended whatever lingering suspicions he might have had. George Lucas on his best day could not have faked this scenery. The cars crossed the Potomac and went north of the George Washington Parkway, finally taking the marked exit to Langley. "So, this is the home of the main enemy," the rabbit said. "I just think of it as the place I used to work."
"Used to?
Didn't you know? I'm stationed back in England now," Jack told him. The whole debriefing team was under the canopy by the main entrance. Ryan knew only one of them, Mark Radner, a Russian scholar from Dartmouth who got called down for some special work. One of the people who liked working for CIA, but not full-time. Ryan was now able to understand that. When the car stopped, he got out first and went to James Greer.
"You've had a busy couple of days, my boy."
"Tell me about it, Admiral."
"How was it in Rome?"
"First, tell me about the Pope," Jack shot back.
"He came through surgery okay. He's critical, but we asked Charlie Weathers up at Harvard about that, and he said not to worry. People that age who come through surgery are always classified as being in critical condition. Probably just a way to drive the bill up. Unless something unusual crops up, he'll probably be fine. Charlie says they grow good cutters in Rome. His Holiness ought to be home in 3 to 4 weeks, Charlie says. They won't rush it with a guy his age."
"Thank God. Sir, when I had that Strokov bastard, I thought we'd done it, you know? And then I heard the shots. Jesus, what a moment that was, Admiral."
Greer nodded. "I can imagine. But the good guys won this one." "Oh, your Orioles took the series from Philly. Game just ended 20 minutes ago. That new shortstop you have, Ripken? Looks to me like he's going places."
"Ryan," Judge Moore came over next. "Well done, son." Another handshake.
"Thank you, Director."
"Nice going, Ryan," Ritter said next. "Sure you wouldn't like to try our training course at the farm?"
The handshake was surprisingly cordial.
Ritter must have had a drink or two in the office, Jack surmised. "Sir, right now I'd be just as happy to go back to teaching history."
"It's more fun to make it, boy. Remember that."
The party moved inside, past the memorial on the right side wall to the dead officers, many of whose names were still secret, then left to the executive elevator. The Rabbit family went its own way. There were hotel-like accommodations for VIP visitors and back from overseas field officers on the 6th floor, and evidently the CIA was bedding them down there. Jack followed the senior executives to the judge's office.
"How good is our new rabbit?" Moore asked.
"Well, sure as hell he gave us good information on the Pope, Judge," Ryan answered in considerable surprise.
"And the Brits sound pretty happy with what he's told them about that agent minister. I'm kind of curious who this Cassius guy is." And Neptune, Greer added. The Navy needed secure communications to survive in the modern world, and James Greer still had blue suits in his closet.
Any other thoughts? This was Moore again.
Has anyone thought about how desperate the Russians are? I mean, sure, the Pope was... I guess he still is a political threat of some sort to them, but... Damn it, this was not a rational operation, was it? Jack asked.
Looks to me as though they're a lot more desperate than we usually think.
We ought to be able to exploit that.
The mixture of alcohol and fatigue made it easier than usual for Ryan to speak his mind, and he'd been chewing on this idea for about 12 hours.
How? Ritter asked, reminding himself that Ryan was something of a whiz at economics.
I'll tell you one thing for sure. The Catholic Church is not going to be very happy.
Lots of Catholics in Eastern Europe, guys. That is a capability we need to think about using. If we approach the church intelligently, they might just cooperate with us. The church is big on forgiveness, sure, but you're supposed to go to confession first.
Moore raised an eyebrow.
The other thing is I've been studying their economy. It's very shaky.
A lot more than our people think it is, Admiral, Jack said, turning to his immediate boss.
What do you mean?
Sir, the stuff our guys are looking at, it's the official economics reports that come into Moscow, right?
We work pretty hard to get it, too, Moore confirmed.
Director, why do we think it's true? Ryan asked.
Just because the Politburo gets it.
We know they lie to us, and they lie to their own people.
What if they lie to themselves?
If I were an examiner for the SEC, I think I could put a whole lot of guys in Allenwood Federal Prison. What they say they have doesn't jibe with what we can identify them as actually having. Their economy is teetering, and if that goes bad, even a little bit, the whole shebang comes down.
How could we exploit that? Ritter asked.
His own blue team analysis had said something very similar 4 days earlier, but even Judge Moore didn't know that.
Where do they get their hard currency? I mean, what do they get it from?
Oil, Greer answered the question. The Russians exported as much oil as the Saudis.
And who controls the world price of oil?
OPEC?
And who, Ryan went on, controls OPEC?
The Saudis.
Aren't they our friends? Jack concluded.
Look at the USSR as a takeover target, like we did at Merrill Lynch. The assets are worth a lot more than the parent corporation because it's so badly run. This isn't hard stuff to figure out. Even by a guy exhausted by a long day, 5,000 miles of air travel and a little too much booze, he didn't add. There were a lot of smart people at CIA, but they thought too much like government workers, and not enough like Americans.
Don't we have anybody who thinks outside the box?
Bob? Moore asked.
Ritter was warming to the young analyst by the minute.
Ryan, you ever read Edgar Allan Poe?
In high school, Ryan replied in some small confusion.
How about a story called The Mask of the Red Death?
Something about a plague coming in to ruin the party, wasn't it?
Get some rest. Before you fly back to London tomorrow, you're going to get briefed in on something.
Sleep sounds like a plan, gentlemen.
Where do I crash for the night? He asked, letting them know, if they hadn't already guessed, that he was ready to collapse.
We have a place for you at the Marriott up the road. You're all checked in. There's a car waiting at the entrance for you.
Go on now, Moore told him.
Maybe he's not so dumb after all, Ritter speculated.
Robert, it's nice to see that you're strong enough to change, Greer smilingly observed as he reached for Moore's own office bottle of expensive bourbon whiskey. It was time to celebrate. The following day, in Il Tempo, a morning newspaper in Rome, was a story about a man found dead in a car of an apparent heart attack. It would be a little time before the body was identified, and it was finally determined that he was a Bulgarian tourist who'd evidently come to the end of his life quite unexpectedly. How clear his conscience had been was not apparent from physical examination. This concludes the reading of Red Rabbit by Tom Clancy. Copyright 2002 by Rubicon Incorporated. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Rubicon Incorporated and was produced in 2002 by Books on Tape Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by Scott Brick. Books on Tape produces many new audiobook titles each month. To find out more about them, call our customer service department at the number which appears on this package, or visit us at our website, www.booksontape.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.